Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loride. Coming up today, we'll look at some of the changes that Governor DeSantis is proposing for voting. He's taking it one step further than the Dennis Baxley bill that was announced 2 weeks ago. So we're going to talk about changes in Florida's voting law first, and then later on in the program, we'll listen back to some of those hearings yesterday on the Capitol insurrection. But first, one listener comment. It's all about the way that Governor DeSantis handled the pop-up vaccine site in Manatee County and allowed people from two of the wealthiest zip codes in Manatee County to get special treatment on vaccines. Here's what one listener had to say.
My name is Carol, and I'm a listener in Sarasota, Florida. I wanted to make a comment about that Lakewood Ranch vaccine distribution. It really disturbed me because throughout this whole COVID pandemic, have we not learned anything about privilege and money, buying whatever you need? The lady that organized that owns Vanessa Jewelers in Lakewood Ranch, and she's a Republican, which is okay, but because she had money and she had a connection with this governor, DeSantis, who should be removed, she was able to get that vaccine for all the rich people in that area. My husband, just along with other people who have high comorbidities, are still waiting to get the vaccine because A, we're not privileged. B, we don't have money connected to Governor DeSantis. I really think this issue needs to be brought out in the light and let people know that the person who runs and owns Vanessa Jewelers is the one who organized that with DeSantis and was able to push that through. It's not about being fair. It's about morals and honor and respect for your fellow man. We're all waiting on the vaccine, but we're not bribing anybody to get it. We're just waiting our turn and praying that we will get it.
And that controversy does continue in Manatee County. That's a comment that came in after Monday's program. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Well, late last Friday, Governor DeSantis unveiled some new proposals to change the way we vote here in the state of Florida. And we're going to talk about that right now with Brad Ashwell, who is the Florida State Director for a group called All Voting is Local. And Brad, welcome to WMNF. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So, Brad, what did the governor propose last Friday?
Well, he kind of surprised a lot of people by making a long list of suggestions, mostly framed as voting integrity and transparency. But I think one of the most problematic ones was building on what Senator Baxley had already filed in the legislature, which would remove a lot of the applications for vote-by-mail ballots. A lot of supervisors spent money educating voters and encouraging them to sign up for vote by mail. A lot of advocacy groups did the same, and we're still in a pandemic. So it's kind of troubling that they want to just wipe out all of that hard work and remove those applications retroactively. He also said he wanted to address ballot drop boxes. It's not clear exactly what he wants to do there yet. I assume, based on their comments, that they want to make them more secure. It's not clear how they want to do that yet. They want to address ballot harvesting, which is when somebody gathers vote-by-mail ballots and collects them and turns them in for them. So maybe a neighborhood association might do that. A church leader might do that. They fear people being unscrupulous actors and doing it, though. And then they talk about some ways they want to create more transparency in elections. But I think our general take on it is that it seems to be a lot of misplaced energy. I mean, we would agree that our election went smoothly this past election cycle for the most part. I mean, there were a lot of problems with voter intimidation and misinformation that don't seem to be addressed by these proposals at all. We would agree that it went smoothly and for the most part, and that we even agree with the idea that we shouldn't rest on our laurels, which is sort of the framing they are using for all this. but it looks like a lot of misplaced energy. They're addressing issues in many cases that just don't exist.
I was looking at some of the quotes of the governor right after the November election, this November, when Donald Trump won statewide, and DeSantis said Florida is a model for the rest of the nation to follow. He said perhaps 2020 was the year we finally vanquished the ghost of Bush versus Gore. So back in November, Governor DeSantis had no trouble or problem with the way that we vote here in Florida, but now he wants to make changes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we had, I think, 4.8 million voters who voted by mail. It went fairly well. We had a very low rejection rate of those vote-by-mail ballots. I think we actually just did a study we'll release soon that looks at some of the patterns and the variety and the way those rejections happen. I think there's some issues there, but overall, they were pretty low. So, I mean, they really could take a victory lap here. It's disconcerting that they would try to restrict or create any barriers to vote by mail, because that's working very, very well. Just looking at the numbers as far as how many Democrats versus Republicans voted by mail, more Democrats did this time. So, you know, his actions look very political.
In 2016, more Republicans voted by mail here in the state of Florida. I think the Republicans beat the Democrats in 2016 by 50,000 votes. So,
yeah, historically, the Republicans have dominated vote by mail. It's just it's kind of a new thing, maybe even a one-time, you know, election cycle dynamic where the Democrats outdid them. But, yeah, it just the fact that they would come back after such a successful election and try to, you know, make it harder to vote by mail is mind-boggling.
So, Brad, what's the trouble? I mean, if you have to sign up every year to get a mail-in ballot, what's the problem with that? I mean, why not have everybody sign up every election year or every year and make sure that they're still alive and they're still living in the same place? And, you know, the election supervisors should check in once a year with all the voters.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. I think except for the budget implications. I mean, that's going to cost money. I think there is a good case to be made that every time you do engage voters, that gets them more engaged. So if supervisors can do that, that's great. The problem is the legislation that's already been proposed doesn't have any fiscal note. It doesn't have any funding for county supervisors to do that. It doesn't even require them to do that. And from what we've seen, we have 67 different supervisors of elections all running elections a little differently in Florida. And some of them don't really have the same ethos for public education that others do. Some of them are very good, some of them aren't. So we would worry that, some supervisors aren't going to do their due diligence on educating voters. The other thing is, this is sort of a solution in search of a problem, and they already have processes for confirming and updating addresses every time a voter interacts with the supervisor's office or the DHSMB. That data gets updated already. So, and then, you know, the state just joined ERIC, an acronym which I can never remember the exact title for, but it's basically a interstate data exchange set up to clean our voter rolls and make sure people aren't on the rolls who shouldn't be, and to update the data. So it's not really clear that this is a problem or needed, but in theory, yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. The big problem is that they would retroactively apply it. So if they take all, literally hundreds of thousands of dollars were spent by almost each county educating their voters and urging them to vote by mail for safety precautions last election cycle. It would literally be lighting a match and burning that money on fire and wasting all those resources, and then not giving them the resources they need to do the education necessary to encourage people to vote by mail moving forward. So, the main issue is economic.
Well, we're talking with Brad Ashwell, the Florida State Director for All Voting is Local, and we're talking about the proposed changes in Florida's voting laws that are being pushed by both Governor DeSantis and the State Senator Dennis Baxley from Ocala, and this is WMNF 88.5 FM. There is a national effort, isn't there, Brad, to limit mail-in voting? I mean, this is not just something that's going on here in Florida. Other states are trying to limit mail-in voting, too.
Yeah, in states where Republican leaders didn't do so well where they have control of legislatures, they are pursuing really bad legislation, and that would be discriminatory and impact a lot of minority voters. Georgia, Pennsylvania, Arizona. You were really hoping we don't see anything along those lines in Florida. I mean, it really would be contrary to the reality here. I mean, they did well. They won the state. So, again, it's kind of mind-boggling that they're coming forward with these things.
Brad, what about people who live overseas or people that are in the military that are voting? How would requesting a mail-in ballot every year or every election year, how would it affect them?
Well, I mean, it just creates another hurdle. I mean, for all voters, it's sort of the opposite of what we would like to see. We would rather see a permanent vote-by-mail application put on the list and the voters opt out just as a convenience factor. The main value of vote-by-mail is the convenience factor. That's why it's so popular. And that issue, that challenge of having to get your information in on time, all those little things that could trip a voter up, regardless of where they live, are amplified when a voter lives overseas. And there are multiple systems required to make sure they get their application, they get the voter information, they get it in on time. So it's basically just amplifying the issues that are a problem to all voters when they're overseas.
Brad, you're with a group called All Voting is Local. Tell us what the purpose of your group is and, for instance, why do you exist?
Well, we're nonpartisan. We exist to eliminate discriminatory barriers to voting. And, there aren't many groups that just focus on election administration. You have advocacy groups who focus on election administration issues year-round. That's what we do. And we really want to work with supervisors of elections and election officials to make changes that are needed that might trip up voters and cause problems, particularly issues that might impact minority voters before they become a big issue. We want to get in and solve problems before they become a big legal fight or a big legislative issue. So that's kind of our mission. I mean, we're an extension of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights.
So Senator Baxley's bill is making its way through committee up there in Tallahassee. The state legislature begins its official meeting next month, but the work has already begun. So if Senator Baxley's bill passes through the committees in the Senate, could other ideas about voting, for instance, what the governor's proposing, could they be added to Baxley's bill and kind of in a flash suddenly come up for a vote?
Yeah, and that, yes, is the short answer. That often happens. And just given the power dynamics and the numbers, the split of Democrats versus Republicans in the legislature, they can largely do what they want. But I think, in every off election year, they usually file a large election package. Ideally, it's a glitch bill that makes small tweaks to things that need to be changed, nothing too crazy, or in some cases, things that might be more ambitious that are bipartisan, like online voter registration was a good example. And actually, that's an issue they should be talking about because we had problems with that system again and have continued to have problems with it. And there's nothing requiring the Secretary of State to do a stress test. I mean, that's the sort of thing they should be focusing on. But, they will likely come forward with a larger package. I think that's what we saw hinted at or foreshadowed with that press event yesterday. I think we'll see a larger package coming out of the House. So I'd read the tea leaves. And, Senator Baxley's bill could very well be the Senate companion to that.
All right. So we could wake up some morning and read online or read in the paper that a bill that was kind of rather limited, that is asking people to sign up for a mail-in ballot every year, might be expanded pretty vastly and on its way to passage. That's the way things work in Tallahassee. Suddenly you wake up and additional items are added to a bill and it really hasn't been fully vetted.
That's right. I mean, oftentimes those bills come out of the committees rather than through a member themselves, and they can come out at any point in the process. There are often surprises, and it happens exactly like you said. Sometimes you'll wake up and suddenly there's a 70-page bill there.
So I didn't realize that we had ballot drop boxes here in Florida. The governor wants to address those. So, do we have ballot drop boxes? How often are they used?
Well, I mean, this is another thing that's sort of mind-boggling. I mean, so in 2019, so there are some counties like Pinellas that have used Dropboxes for a long time. Some supervisors have just had one out in front of their office in other counties. In 2019, SB 7066 created statute that required them to have Dropboxes at every early voting location and every branch location, main office. And then it also allowed them some flexibility to put Dropboxes at any location that could be an early voting site as long as it was secure. And then what security means is a little ambiguous because the statute doesn't quite fit with what the Division of Elections put into rule. The division put in that it had to be staffed, and that's ambiguous in statute. So one of the things I think we could see them do is try to address the security of Dropboxes. And this is kind of an interesting issue because, one, it was, you know, Dropboxes were wildly popular this past election cycle. Voters used them, and they were very effective. In some counties, they were staffed, some they weren't. There's a lot of variety in how they were applied. And I think there were some best practices that could guide some legislation. I think they could address or create a little more consistency in how they're being used. So the devil's going to be in the details. It'll be interesting to see what they come out with there. You know, one thing we would be interested in is seeing them just improve the accessibility of the Dropboxes by making sure voters know how to find them. Supervisors in different counties varied wildly on how they made that information available. You know, some didn't have it at all. Others had a list of the locations or a map of the locations right on their website. Hillsborough is a good example of that. They had a map that was very easy to look at and identify where your Dropboxes would be. Other counties weren't like that. So, you know, we would love, in an ideal world, to see every supervisor have a locator tool on their website where you can just type in your address and boom, it gives you the Dropboxes that are closest to you.
So but, you wouldn't mind if they address that. That's okay.
I think the security question could, the devil's going to be in the details. You know, if they do it in a way where it's very restrictive and it severely limits where supervisors can put them, it could undermine one of the main benefits of them, which is supervisors can place them in rural areas and places they might not be able to find a location for an early voting site, but they can put a Dropbox there and voters have an easier option. So if it dramatically, whatever they do, dramatically reduces the options, that could be bad. We're just going to have to see. I don't think they're even looking at some of the things they could be considering.
Well, we're talking with Brad Ashwell of the group All Voting is Local, and this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I think when it comes to ballot drop boxes or ballot harvesting, I know there's going to be a lot of talk at the CPAC convention in Orlando this weekend about stolen elections. I think there's a feeling by some that if you're dropping off a mail-in ballot or somebody's harvesting ballots, that these are just it's one person who's in a factory signing 100 or 500 ballots and they're dropping them off. But that's not the way the system works. You can't have one person signing his signature over and over again in somebody else's name to get that ballot counted.
No, I mean, the supervisors of elections have a very rigorous signature matching process, and that's one of the vote-by-mail ballots. You know, they compare it to signatures they've had on file. Oftentimes, that's from the DHSMV office or, you know, voter registration form. It's very hard for someone to know that many signatures. I mean, actually, that's one of, you know, our concern isn't so much people fraudulently filing vote-by-mail ballots. It's more protecting those legitimate, eligible voters who have filed them who are getting rejected because their signature doesn't match. So I think, if anything, the supervisors lean a little more the other way in terms of rejecting them. And you know, the canvassing boards, that's what they do. If there's a question of the signature, you know, most supervisors will have several layers of their process where they compare to, you know, they have staff comparing it to what they have on file. Then if there's a question still, it goes to the canvassing board. The canvassing board, you know, evaluates it oftentimes on a projection screen where the public can monitor and watch it and step in if they disagree. So it's kind of a non-issue. I think the concern there is that there are instances where you would need an individual to collect vote-by-mail ballots that haven't been turned in yet. I mean, of course, they would have been signed by the voter themselves, but gather them and submit them for them. And, you know, seniors come to mind. I could see seniors in some instances being impacted, or maybe those at assisted living facilities. You know, it's easy to see where some people might be adversely impacted by that if they get too restrictive.
Brad, one last question. Do we need some sort of new National Voting Rights Act? Because the Supreme Court has whittled away at the original Voting Rights Act. Do we need something from Washington that establishes the right to vote and making it easier for people to vote?
Yeah, we do. I mean, that's, you know, the what we have in Congress right now, H.R. 1 and H.R. 4 would be landmark voting rights and civil rights changes. We have a historic opportunity to get those passed. I mean, I think the main thing that we lost were preclearance provisions and ongoing monitoring by the Department of Justice on issues, and that kept check not only in Florida but all the states.
What does preclearance mean?
Well, a number of jurisdictions, in some cases states, in some cases just counties within a state, who had a history of voter suppression or civil rights issues relating to voting, they were subject to preclearance by the Department of Justice so that if they made any changes to their voting rules that might impact minorities, it had to get pre-cleared by the Department of Justice. So that was gutted in a case called Shelby v. Holder, and I believe it was 2012 or 2013. And ever since, groups like ours have been fighting in D.C. to get protections reinstated. One of the other, it's sort of related to preclearance, but it's distinct, is just an ongoing monitoring of the changes that are going on at the local and state level by the Department of Justice that would impact minorities. That went away too, which, you know, I can say that dramatically changed my work. I mean, the importance of monitoring these changes and their impacts and documenting them became exponentially more important after that lawsuit.
Yeah, I remember complaints about local election supervisors in this area who limited the number of polling places in African American and Latino communities and had plenty of polling places in wealthier and white communities.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, we've actually, our national group, the Leadership Conference, has done several reports called Democracy Diverted, just on the poll closures issue, looking at the impact of losing the preclearance provision and how that's led to poll place consolidation in a number of areas, which has the exact impact you were just laying out. And that's kind of related to another issue, to bring it back to the state. You know, another issue, priority of the supervisors, I think it's their third priority, is to move towards a vote centers model. And that can be a positive change. But if not done right, that could basically have all the same problems that large-scale poll place consolidation would have as well.
And what would that entail, a vote center model?
Well, it's basically they're calling them super voting sites, and it's basically going to a model where you have fewer large sites and less precinct, local precinct places. The bill they have filed would basically, it almost mirrors our early voting statute. So it'd be very similar to how early voting works now, where you have these fewer and larger sites and they go through early, what we now think of as early voting, on into election day, and it's just the same site. So what, you know, that would actually address a couple of the problems we have now. One is that voters often get confused that their early voting site isn't the same as their election day site. And it would also solve the problem of voters' ballots getting rejected because they vote provisionally at the wrong polling place on election day. Those issues would be resolved. So there are some positives. The negatives are that voters don't know that we've gone to this new model and that the poll place they've used for 70 years is gone. They might get confused if they're set up in a way that disregards public transit options. Voters might not be able to get to them. And then there are all sorts of things they could do that aren't in the current law, like, you know, they really should require supervisors to do racial impact analyses, to get community input, and weigh all that and where they set up these sites.
Brad, and is that being considered in Florida now, or is this something that's being done elsewhere?
Both. It is, I believe there's 17 states that currently use vote centers, and Florida does have a bill, 635, and I believe it's 774. I'd have to look up the number. I don't remember offhand, but it's the supervisors of elections, the FSE's third priority based on what they said in committee last week.
All right, so that's the bipartisan group of supervisors of elections that think it is a good move. Brad, there is a caller. Let's take this caller who has a question, I think. Doug in Clearwater is calling in. Doug, thanks for calling. You're on with Brad Ashwell.
Well, good morning. I actually was just going to give you a laundry list of things I wanted to talk about, Rob. But
okay, not elections? Well, Doug, if you hold on, I'll bring you back, okay?
Yeah, okay, thank you.
All right, so not about elections. Brad, if people want to find out more about your group, all voting is local, and if they want to kind of track what the governor is proposing to limit voting here in the state of Florida, limit mail-in voting, for instance, how can they track it?
Well, our website is allvotinglocal.org, but they could also sign up to receive bill alerts on either the Florida Senate or Florida House website. I think, listening to your, to Rob Lora, WMF, and your local news is very important. Florida Politics and Safey, I think, still are two websites that people often look at. But, the website, the bill tracking tools on the Senate and House websites are very good. And that's a good way. So the vote center's bill is SB 774 and HB 635. If they wanted to follow that, you could, get email updates anytime a change happens on those bills.
Well, Brad Ashwell, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming by. It's a really important issue, and let's hope that they don't limit people's right to vote.
I'm with you. And hopefully we have some good progress at the federal level. And I've been very helpful for HR1 and HR4.
All right, Brad Ashwell, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming on MNF.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you. That's Brad Ashwell, who is the Florida State Director of a group called All Voting is Local. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM, and we'll continue. I promise we'll continue to track what the legislature does about voting. I'm going to move to a different topic right now. Capitol police officers were underprepared for the insurrectionist mob that stormed the Capitol on January 6th. Many men and women tasked with defending Congress didn't even have the basic protective equipment. Steve Sun, the former U.S. Capitol police chief who was in charge during the insurrection and has since resigned, testified yesterday in Congress and said drills and safety measures set up before January 6th did little to prepare officers for the attack. So we're going to listen to Sun's testimony right now on 88.5 FM. And in a moment, we'll take your phone calls at 813-239-9663. Here's the former U.S. Capitol Police Chief.
Good morning, Chairwoman Klobuchar, Ranking Member Blunt, Chairman Peters, and Ranking Member Portman. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify before your two committees regarding the attack on the United States Capitol that occurred January 6th. I have been in policing for almost 30 years. The events I witnessed on January 6th was the worst attack on law enforcement and our democracy that I have seen in my entire career. I witnessed insurgents beating police officers with fists, pipes, sticks, bats, metal barricades, and flagpoles. These criminals came prepared for war. They came with their own radio system to coordinate the attack and climbing gear and other equipment to defeat the Capitol's security features. I am sickened by what I witnessed that day. Our officers fought valiantly using batons, shields, chemical munitions, and pepper ball guns to hold back the attackers. Capitol Police and responding law enforcement agencies showed tremendous restraint by not using their firearms, which would have likely led to a more chaotic situation and a possible mass casualty incident. No civilian law enforcement agency, to include the United States Capitol Police, is trained or equipped to repel an insurrection of thousands of individuals focused on breaching a building at all costs. I am extremely proud and appreciative of the Capitol Police officers, the Metropolitan Police Department, and the other law enforcement agencies that came to our assistance. A clear lack of accurate and complete intelligence across several federal agencies contributed to this event, and not poor planning by the United States Capitol Police. We rely on accurate information from our federal partners to help us develop effective security plans. The intelligence that we based our planning on indicated that the January 6th protests were expected to be similar to the previous MAGA rallies in 2020, which drew tens of thousands of participants. The assessment indicated that members of the Proud Boys, white supremacist groups, Antifa, and other extremist groups were expected to participate on January 6th, and that they may be inclined to become violent. Based on the intelligence that we received, we planned for an increased level of violence at the Capitol, and that some participants may be armed. But none of the intelligence we received predicted what actually occurred. Extensive preparations were put into place for January 6th that included the full activation of the department, intelligence and information sharing with our federal and local partners and department officials, implementing a significant enhancement for member protection, extensive operational enhancements to include significant civil disobedience deployment, and an expanded perimeter. We also distributed additional protective equipment for our officers and coordinated outside agency support. As recent as Tuesday, January 5th, during a meeting I hosted with my executive team, the Capitol Police Board, and a dozen of the top law enforcement and military officials from D.C., no entity, including the FBI, provided any new intelligence regarding January 6th. It should be also noted that the Secretary of Homeland Security did not issue an elevated or imminent alert in reference to the events at the United States Capitol on January 6th. We properly planned for a mass demonstration with possible violence. What we got was a military-style coordinated assault on my officers and a violent takeover of the Capitol building. I know that the images we saw of the officers battling for their lives and the visuals on national TV had a profound effect on the nation. The United States Capitol Police did everything we could based on the intelligence and available resources to prepare for this event. While my officers were fighting, my post was in the command center coordinating resources from numerous agencies around the National Capital Region to provide critically needed support. I was also briefing the two sergeant-at-arms and working on establishing accountability and priorities for the incoming resources. As Capitol Police and outside resources began to reestablish the security perimeter, I responded to the Capitol building to personally evaluate the situation and brief the sergeant-at-arms and leadership. I acknowledge that under the pressure of an unprecedented attack, a number of systems broke down. One of the reported issues described by officers was a lack of clear communications and directions from officials. It appears that the established incident command for the Capitol building was overwhelmed by the enormity of the situation and as officials battling insurrections as opposed to directing the response. There have also been reports that some officers may have felt confused or let down during the attack. As an official who cares as much as I do about my colleagues, nothing is more painful to me. These issues must be addressed through new training, policies, and procedures. Even our best efforts were not enough to stop this unprecedented assault on the Capitol. However, casting blame solely on United States Capitol Police leadership is not only misplaced, but it also minimizes what truly occurred that day. The focus going forward needs to be on the efforts to improve intelligence and the coordination of security measures between all involved agencies. Hopefully, this will be part of the focus of an independent after-action committee to look at all aspects of the January attack on our nation's capital. In closing, I want to again recognize the heroic efforts of the Capitol Police officers, who on January 6th, outnumbered and against the odds, successfully carried out their mission to protect the members of Congress and the legislative process. I couldn't have been more proud to be part of their team and the USCP mission. I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
All right, so that was the opening testimony of Steve Sund, the former U.S. Capitol Police Chief who was in charge during the insurrection. Sund and everybody else that testified yesterday all said they did not see a threat report issued by the FBI office in Virginia that detailed online threats related to January 6th. Sun said that he only found out within the last 24 hours that his agency did receive the FBI report on January 5th, the day before the attack. The FBI report that they got from Virginia is harrowing. And I'll just read from USA Today, which reported this on Monday. The FBI issued a dire warning on the day before the Capitol riots that violent extremists were planning an armed uprising, in Washington, D.C., a plot that attackers describe as war, to coincide with Congress's certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College victory. The contents of the warning that were first disclosed by the Washington Post included ominous language calling for the attackers to be ready to fight. Congress needs to hear glass breaking. Doors need to be kicked in. Go there, ready for war. We get our president or we die. Nothing else will achieve the goal, the Post reported, citing the document. So that was a warning that came in the day before the Capitol insurrection that Mr. Sun said he didn't see. We're going to open up the phone lines in a little bit. If you want to comment, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. As you know, there's a lot of people that are downplaying what happened on January 6th. People think that it really does not amount to much. But Liz Cheney, the third-ranking House Republican, yesterday warned her party against becoming complacent and against becoming the party of white supremacy. Pretty strong words. Cheney's a pretty out there conservative, too. She's very conservative. She did this at an event hosted by the Reagan Institute. It was a Zoom call, and we're going to hear what Liz Cheney warned the Republican Party about yesterday. Here's her words.
On January 6th, our institutions held. It was very important that we in the House and our colleagues in the Senate were able to return to our chambers, were able to continue and to complete the counting of the electoral votes, and not allow the violent mob to stop that or to delay it. And so the institutions held. But it also was a reminder of how close they came to not holding. As we look at what's necessary to protect and defend our system, it really is incumbent upon those of us who are elected officials. It's incumbent upon those who serve, incumbent upon everybody who takes an oath of office and swears to protect and defend the Constitution, that we recognize what happened on January 6th, that we commit ourselves that it must never happen again, that we recognize the damage that was done by the president, President Trump, saying that somehow the election was stolen, making those claims for months, and summoning the mob and provoking them then in the attack on the Capitol. And very importantly, in refusing, despite multiple requests from people to ask him to stop what was happening, to ask him to stop the violence, to protect the Capitol, to protect the counting of electoral votes, he didn't do so. And I think that one of the most important things that we need to demonstrate to the world, but more importantly, that we need to make sure that we do to protect our system and to protect our republic, is to be clear that is behavior that is absolutely unacceptable behavior. It's dangerous. It's an existential threat to who we are, and it can't be minimized or trivialized, and it can never happen again.
Yeah, and those were words you used in your remarks, that we should not trivialize, we should not minimize. Obviously, by speaking out and addressing the issue like you've done today is one way not to trivialize and not to minimize it. Is there anything else that you think we as a country ought to do, the Congress ought to do, the conference in which you're chair of ought to do to make sure we're not trivializing or minimizing, or is it exhausted by what we're doing here today, what you're speaking about?
No, I think that it's a good question, Roger. I think there are many things. I think, first of all, certainly the potential of a 9/11 style commission, I think that's very important. I think there are many aspects to what happened on the 6th and in the days, weeks, and months leading up to it, that have to be investigated. And I think having a commission with the formality that we saw in the 9/11 commission, with the bipartisan participation that we saw in the 9/11 commission, that's very important. A commission with subpoena power, a commission that really is able, and I think it should have retired officials on it. I don't think you should have current officials on the commission. I really think the model that was used in the aftermath of 9/11 is a good one. So I think that's important. I think there will be criminal investigations that are going on and that will be ongoing. But I think while those things are happening, it's very important for us to ignore the temptation to look away. And it's very important, especially for us as Republicans, to make clear that we aren't the party of white supremacy. You certainly saw anti-Semitism. You saw the symbols of Holocaust denial, for example, at the Capitol that day. You saw a Confederate flag being carried through the rotunda. And I think we as Republicans in particular have a duty and an obligation to stand against that, to stand against insurrection.
Liz Cheney, the third-ranking House Republican from she's represents the state of Wyoming in the U.S. Congress, a warning that the Republican Party shouldn't become the party of white supremacy. She noted the anti-Semitic symbols and Holocaust denial symbols and the Confederate flag on the Capitol on January 6th or at the Capitol on January 6th, and she says that Republicans should not become the party of insurrection. So what do you think? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. I mentioned earlier that some Republicans are downplaying what happened at the Capitol on January 6th. One of those Republicans is Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, who read from a conservative publication yesterday at yesterday's hearings. He read from The Federalist, and this is what he said.
Many of the marchers were families with small children. Many were elderly, overweight, or just plain tired or frail. Traits not typically attributed to the riot prone. Many wore pro-police shirts or carried pro-police black and blue flags. Although the crowd represented a broad cross-section of Americans, mostly working class by their appearance and manner of speech, some people stood out. A very few didn't share the jovial, friendly, earnest demeanor of the great majority. Some obviously didn't fit in, and he describes four different types of people: plainclothes militants, agents provocateurs, fake Trump protesters, and then disciplined uniformed column of attackers. I think these are the people that probably planned this.
All right, so that's the senator from Wisconsin, Ron Johnson, kind of dismissing the fact that thousands of people took part in that insurrection on January 6th, trying to say that some people really weren't involved in that insurrection. This is what the insurrection sounded like, and this is what Steve Sund was talking about a moment ago. Some of the sound was some of the hand-to-hand combat that took place on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. So at yesterday's hearing, another senator spoke up, Amy Klobuchar, the Democrat from Minnesota. She spoke up and took issue with Ron Johnson's comments.
There is clear agreement that this was a planned insurrection. So, and I think most members here very firmly agree with that. And I think it's important for the public to know that. This was planned. We now know this was a planned insurrection. It involved white supremacists. It involved extremist groups. And it certainly could have been so much worse except for the bravery of the officers.
Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota. Well, let's take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. You can also send your email into the studio, dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Doug in Clearwater. Doug, thanks for calling in. What would you like to comment about?
Hey, Rob. Thank you. I could go on and on, but I'm going to... The simple thing would be I'm a little bit disappointed that
Nestle is going to be able to pull 1 million gallons of water out every day from the springs for free, unless legal action stops them from doing that. I hope it does. I would like to see more people uprised and not allow it go to the courts and just, but I guess everybody that called in said, no, we don't want you to do that. More people said, yeah, it's okay. And unanimously they decided it's all right. So you got that. But the other thing I really would also add in is, and this is, I guess, more conspiratorial or whatever you want to call it. You know, the uprising on January 6th at the Capitol, you had the second and third in line for power of this country. And I don't know. I can't find out where Harris was. I've looked, and I don't see it online. But there was nothing that the Secret Service or intelligence had to keep that from happening. I mean, that seems...
Yeah. All right. Well, Doug, thanks a lot. Thanks for making the points. You know, let's hope that there is a 9/11 style commission to investigate that. And if you missed it yesterday on WMNF and this morning on MNF, we heard Daniel Figueroa IV's report on the decision to allow Nestle's to pump 1 million gallons of water a day from the Ginny Springs, which is just northwest of Gainesville. Well, if you want to comment about anything, call us up, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Jackie, who's in New York State. Jackie, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Good morning. A couple of points about the January 6th wake-up call. I think we should stay awake. and I think it starts in our communities. Because, you know, the man who said they had pro-police shirts, well, you know, I think it's coming out that there were some ex-military and police officers there, and they're being recruited by, you know, groups that are bringing them in from local police agencies. So talking to your head of your local police force, I think, is really important to flesh out where that person stands. We have an elected sheriff here, and I really want to keep tabs on, you know, what's happening in that department and how he handles things like this. The other thing is, beyond, you know, the borders of states, I think we need to look at places where people like the insurrectionists are trained. There's a place about 45 minutes from me that's huge. It's called Slate Ridge. It trains Oath Keepers and the Green Mountain State Militia, which is in Vermont, which is a anti-police force kind of thing that's a that takes up arms against the people who don't want to, who want to have gun control. So gun control, you know, varies across states, and I think we have to pay attention to what people are doing all over the country. And
all right. And Jackie, where in New York State are you? Jackie, where in New York State are you?
I am 45 minutes from Rutland, Vermont, so across the border in the Adirondacks.
Okay, so you're kind of directly north of New York City?
Up the way there.
All right, Jackie, thanks a lot. Thank you for calling in. Good to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Kevin in Sarasota writes, citizens should be reminded that when actual examples of voter fraud have been uncovered, it's been Republicans that have been caught, writes Kevin in Sarasota. And then another Kevin writes, the people who stormed the Capitol were so full of hate that all it took was Trump's lie to ignite the flames of violence that shook our democracy to its core. It'll be interesting to see whether or not they talk about the stolen election at the CPAC convention this weekend in Orlando, if that lie continues. Let's go to John in Newport Richey. John, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, thanks for the show, Rob. A couple of things. First of all, Ron Johnson is doing what the Republicans do our best at, is making the false equivalencies when he was comparing the people in the crowd. But he also mentioned something that I haven't heard from him, but I heard some people that I know talking, was surprised me, that they're saying that oh, this demonstration was staged by the Democrats. It was set up, and the Democrats did it all. And they were, Nancy Pelosi was in charge of the police. And I'm just, where did they get this information from? I mean, obviously that guy's spreading the same misinformation, but it just blew me away when they told me that, and they were so earnest. It's like, no, the Democrats planned this and they did this. These weren't Trump people. And I even said, well, what about those people that were arrested and said they were Trump supporters? Oh no, that was all staged. I'm like, okay. I just like really blew me away when I heard that.
Well, in addition to running the House of Representatives, she's also planning a phony insurrection. I think that's, and thanks a lot for the call, John. I think that's why we need a 9/11 style commission to see what actually went on and get to the bottom of that and dismiss some of these conspiracy theories. Brian writes, this, my response to Senator Johnson is this: if you want to preserve your freedom and keep our democracy, never vote Republican. It is that critical for the survival of our country, writes Brian. And let's go to Nancy in St. Petersburg. Hi, Nancy, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi, yeah. Something that I haven't heard addressed yet is that say the insurrection had succeeded. Exactly what was their plan after that? What form of government would they like to see initiated in place of our democracy should they have succeeded?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that would be another question for the for
Wouldn't
her commission. Yeah, it would be.
What was their plan after that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Nancy, thanks a lot. I don't think they were, I think they had a plan to try to take over. I don't think they had a plan what to do next. Let's go to Danny in Tampa. Danny, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Hey, good morning, Rob. I think that Ron Johnson should be expelled from Congress. He's been lying all of the with a stolen list, claiming a stolen election, and now these outrageous lies about fake Trump protesters were a part of it. The fake Trump protesters. Yeah, the people who voted. Yeah, the Biden supporters are going to go after they won the election, and they're going to go storm the Capitol and protest that Trump didn't win. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's unbelievable. I mean, it's just. These people, you know, and to look to Donald Trump at CPAC, he's going to be talking about that this Sunday, and I don't see how that's their future. By the way, Tucker Carlson last night said that there was no evidence of white supremacists at the insurrection. Really? Well, I believe that they arrested some people from the Proud Boys and some people from the old Cape.
Well, what was the Confederate flag about?
Yeah, what was that about? No, but there was no evidence. No, you know, these
what was the Holocaust denier doing there?
Yeah, right, exactly.
With the T-shirt.
Holocaust denier. Right, yeah.
What was the Nazi flag doing there?
What was the Nazi flag doing? How about Hail Hitler? I heard a couple of people say, Hail Hitler, you know? No, but there was
What network is Tucker Carlson watching, Danny?
I have no idea, but I'll tell you one thing. Them and Newsmax and these people, they're just with. And then Donald Trump, I believe, is not going to be able to be viable for to win the House for them again. He cost them the House and the Senate. He cost them both. So, and I believe Donald Trump's going to be facing some jail time.
All right, Danny. Thanks.
Thank you, Rob.
Thoughts. We're getting a lot of emails. Tom writes this: as I was listening to the interview, I was wondering whether the demand for mail ballots will be as strong in 2022 if the COVID situation improves. That's a good question, Tom. You may be right. Maybe there'll be less demand for mail-in ballots. Greg writes this: how much kickback does DeSantis of Florida and the GOP, how much do they get from Nestle's? I don't know. You know, I haven't looked into the campaign contributions. I don't know. Let's go to David in Pasco County. David, thanks for calling. We just have 20 seconds. What would you like to say?
Rob, I'd like to say shame on those commissioners and who people made that happen up there in
at Ginny Springs
County, that the pump into that river. You know, I mean, shame on them.
Yeah.
It's not just the impact of the spring. It's the impact of the roads and the communities. And one of the things I'd like to bring up, if you have time, would you research Claude Kirk?
Okay. All right. The former governor, the Republican governor, who is a strong environmentalist. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks for listening. This is WMNF in Tampa. And thanks to Jessica Green, our phone producer today. You've been listening to Radioactivity.